listening to The Finalysis with Travis Wingfield and Kevin Dern. Brought to you by WelcomeToPerfectville.com. Prepare to go deep.
That's another Dolphins rookie contribution and another Miami Dolphins win, making it three in a row for the Dolphins, and they are officially streaking for the first time since Week 9 of 2014. Welcome back to another edition of the Finalysis Podcast. I am your host, Travis Wingfield. That was Greg Gumbel with the call on CBS, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Kevin Dern. Kevin, what's happening, man?
Oh, not too much. Just taking a break from watching the election results, enjoying a little victory beer from our Dolphins three-game winning streak, ready to go tonight.
That's what's on the TV downstairs right now, and I had to get away from it. I was super excited that we're doing this tonight because I can't stand that election coverage. It's pretty much wearing me thin, so I'm glad we're doing this and talking about the Dolphins and a three-game winning streak and back-to-back wins over the Jets and the Bills. And that's actually first of my notes here today we're going to talk about a little bit was that the fact that we have beaten the Jets and Bills in back-to-back games. I don't really know the housekeeping on that, but when was the last time we beat them in back-to-back games, or at least beat the two opponents back-to-back? Do you have any idea about that, Kevin?
The best guess I can think of is back in 2012. I remember we beat the Jets in New York, and then we beat Buffalo at home, like, real late in the season. But I think we lost on the road in between at Buffalo on that Thursday night game. But that's the last season I can think of where we beat both of them in the same year.
It's been a big thorn in the side for this team for several years now, and especially last year getting swept by both teams in embarrassing fashion on both times. And we said this last week how it was nice to come out and run the ball on the Bills and kind of take it to them. We did the same thing against the Jets with Jay Ajayi. We'll get to that in a minute again. But, this team's looking good. The playoff hopes are looking a lot better than they were 3 weeks ago, that's for sure. And Kevin and I have been spending a lot of time talking about plausible scenarios for how the Dolphins get in. But, you know, enough of that for now. We're just 4-4, but it feels good to get some wins out of the way. And, Kevin, I was going to ask you, have you had much of a chance to watch any of, like, the mainstream medias this week, or ESPN or NFL Network, anything like that?
I try and watch a little bit of NFL Network when I can, but, honestly, this week I've been pretty busy trying to get done for the year-end stuff, so I really haven't had much of a chance.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I tend to flip on or DVR some of the shows just to kind of get a kick for myself after Dolphins wins to see what kind of respect level we get. And I guess it's more of being a masochist at this point because I know it's not going to happen. But I turned on NFL primetime. I'm a big fan of watching the Monday night game, which that was a great game last night with the Bills and the Seahawks and the Bills losing, which helped the Dolphins quite a bit. After that game, they'll show the Scott Van Pelt show, which I love. He's the only guy on ESPN worth watching for me. And then after that, NFL primetime is usually an okay show, but last night I turned it on and they had the Dolphins and Jets highlight and they played circus music during it. And Trey Wingo at the end of the segment said that the Dolphins and Jets set football back 20 to 30 years. Now, I know it wasn't the most clean game, but I mean, give me a break. This three games in a row. We're running the ball really well. We're playing solid defense. I just don't understand where he's coming from on that point.
I think it has to be more towards the Jets. I mean, how many times do you throw an interception to a nose tackle? And, you know, just they had a lot of stupid penalties that kind of helped Miami out. I think, what was that, the third straight game Miami hasn't turned the ball over. So, you know, I mean, yeah, we're going with the old school, you know, run the ball down your throats approach. But, I mean, I don't know. I guess I had to watch that to kind of get the feel for that one. But, you know, I think it's more of the Jets than Miami from him, but we'll see.
I like the optimistic view, and I'm typically an optimist too, but I feel like every network kind of disses on us, and that's okay, I guess. You know, we've been pretty bad for a long time. Let's start winning some games and kind of proving some people wrong. Yeah. I also had a chance to look at some of the power rankings today. ESPN also has us at 25th in the NFL. We're 4-4, and we're 25th in the power rankings, meaning there's only six or seven teams that are worse than us. They have Carolina, Tennessee, Indianapolis, Buffalo, New Orleans, Philadelphia, San Diego, Arizona, and Baltimore all ahead of us. Some of these teams with worse records, some of these teams with just coming off of 3-4 game losing streaks, some of these teams looking awful on one side of the ball, just complete dumpster fires. I don't understand it, but it is what it is. Like I said, we have to prove ourselves, and I think with the soft schedule coming up, we definitely have an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I think some of that with the ESPN is just kind of that Northeast East Coast bias thing. Because I mean, I looked at some of the other power rankings. I usually like reading Elliot Harrison's on NFL.com, and he's got us and the Chargers at 16 and 17. So Miami's at 17 on that, and then Pete Prisco, who's usually a Dolphins basher for CBS Sports, actually has us at 15, and I think that was the highest I've seen. So I don't know if it's just an ESPN thing or what, but I think people are starting to take notice. And, you know, Prisco had us moving up 5 spots this week. Elliot Harrison had us moving up 5 spots this week. So I think a road win in San Diego would do a lot to kind of, you know, put the Dolphins a little bit back in the spotlight.
It would. And it's been a tough place for the Dolphins to play the last few times out. I know last year they got demolished by 30 or 40 points or something. I don't know. That was the point of the season where I kind of stopped caring, but it was a beatdown last year, and they haven't fared well there in the past. I have a buddy that is a big Chargers fan, lives in San Diego, and we bet a hat on the game. So whoever loses has to send the other guy a hat. So really hoping to get that done for our playoff hopes and for my headgear. So during this game yesterday, on Sunday, I should say, I was, you know, really up and down, just like the Buffalo game, kind of living and dying with every single play. And that Matt Dar drop punt snap was just so demoralizing. And I was telling some people around here that I'm kind of fighting a cold right now. And I think the reason for that is because my immune system couldn't handle all the ups and downs of that game. So I'm battling through it. We're playing sick here today, but we're going to get through it. We're going to bring some offensive film notes for you. I spent a lot of time at work today. I hope my boss doesn't listen to this, watching the Dolphins game film and breaking down their offense. I got a chance to look at all the plays several times. So I've got you covered there. Kevin's got you on the defense, as always. And Kevin, you got anything to say before I kick off the film study review?
It was actually kind of weird for me watching that game. I was probably more of a nervous wreck during the Bills game. I think for me, just when we went down and scored the touchdown in the first quarter, you know, and just kind of moved it right down the field on them, I was really worried about what Miami would do to kind of offset that Jets run defense. And when we scored there, I don't know, I felt like Miami was going to win that. They were on schedule. You know, the last couple of weeks, teams have basically been scoring because of Dolphins mistakes, you know, shooting ourselves in the flipper, as I'm starting to call it. You know, when Dar dropped that punt, that was bad. But the way the defense was playing, you know, I thought we would be able to, you know, come back and win that game. And, you know, I guess I got to give myself a pat on the back for calling Kenyon Drake with the big play. I said that in the last podcast. I thought it would be more of a passing game play, but he did the kickoff return, and glad we came out with the W.
Yeah, you did. He mentioned that last episode, Kevin did, and said that Kenyon Drake's going to make a big play, so he was spot on there. And after the, I don't know if you want to call it a phantom block in the back on the Jakeem Grant punt return that got called back for a block in the back on the Dolphins, I think I had texted Kevin and said, well, there's your big play from Kenyon Drake, just kind of not how he thought it was. So good on him for getting redemption, even though I'm not sure that was his penalty to begin with. But yeah, I mean, this offense is rolling still, or not rolling, but it was looking good for the first half, and then it kind of sputtered down. But the same consistency that we've had this year in the last two games, or not three games now, with running the football with Jay Ajayi, it's the same story again. He's first for me to get to here. Just watching this guy play, he's for real to me. His one cut style, the way he gets up the field and he moves forward up the field rather than laterally when he makes his cuts, his side to side agility is great, but when he makes his cuts and plants his foot and gets on the ground and gets upfield, he's going forward. And every time he takes on that contact, he's carrying defenders forward for extra yardage. And it's so crucial when you have a game plan that's predicated on play action and running the ball, because you're turning these second and eights into second and six and second and five, and it makes the play calling a lot easier for Adam Gase and the offense. So love the way he's running. He's running inspired. He's playing with more passion than anyone I've seen on the Dolphins this year, or in recent memory at least. Couple times in the game, they had schemed David Harris to be unblocked, and it was kind of Jay Ajayi's responsible to make a miss or find the cutback lane opposite the formation of where Harris was, and he was very successful in doing that. So I think a key matchup in that game was Ajayi versus Harris, and Ajayi won that. He looked good catching the football at the end of the drive. At the end of the first half, there was a drive where they threw to him three consecutive times, and he caught one flare pass and put a stiff arm on the defensive back. I'm not sure who it was, but he plants them on the ground. That was awesome to see. His 5.9 yards per carry is best in the NFL. The next closest is 5.1 for LeSean McCoy. And Jay Ajayi's six rushing touchdowns is eighth in the NFL. So he is getting it done with a limited amount of carries, really, when you consider the fact that he didn't carry the ball much the first month of the season. So he's tearing up the league right now. He's the talk of the team. I thought would be the talk of the league, but apparently I'm wrong on that. Got to win a few more games first. But Jay Ajayi is just getting it done. And you know, with elections being tonight, I'm voting for him for president. How about you, Kevin?
I already voted today, so I can't vote for him for president, and he's not a U.S. citizen, but I would if he was. So, but let me ask you this. I know Sam posted it on Perfectville. The poll question this past week was, how many yards did you think Jay Ajayi was going to run for? And I'll admit it, I actually picked whatever category was like less than 100. I thought he was going to get right around 75 or 80. So what did you think? Like, did he meet your expectations? Did he break them? He certainly smashed through what I was expecting. So what was your take on that?
Yeah, he did. Actually, the members of the vote on that poll got it right with the 100 to 150 yard in that range category. They voted that the most popular one. But I was with you. I had him at about 20 carries for 65, 70 yards, you know, not like 3.5 yards a carry, not very much. And that's kind of how it was looking through the first three quarters. But he did what he always does, and it's not Miami Heat, it's not a fluke, it's Jay Ajayi and the way he runs and the way this offense is committing to the running game, and he's just wearing down defenses. And you look at the end of games, these guys have no interest in tackling him. And
I think he had 59 yards in the fourth quarter of that game.
That's how you win games in this league, when it's, you know, in tight ball games. So it's good to see him doing that. And Adam Gase, credit for him for sticking by him, because there's no way Bill Lazor would have done that last year. So very big ups to the coaching staff for that. And speaking of that coaching staff, I wanted to get to Adam Gase. He was actually on top of my list, but I had to get to Ajayi first because he's the stud. But let's get into Adam Gase a little bit, and then we can talk about some Vance Joseph if you've got some notes on him. But Adam Gase's play calling, I charted him in the first half, and I had him down as Bobby Fischer again. He was awesome. He was setting plays up ahead of time. He was using motion across the formation, and you know, Tannehill has his free with the line of scrimmage, but he was calling plays with a purpose, and he was running these misdirection plays where he was kind of motioning halfway across the formation and then shifting back. And like the play to Landry, for instance, where he dumped it off to Landry and he picked it off the ground and ran over a ball.
That was a sweet catch.
Yeah, it was awesome. Just an awesome play by Jarvis Landry on that. But that play design was awesome, and they did it again later in the game with Kenyon Drake, where they swung it out to him, and he had a big catch and run. You saw some of that ability from Drake there. But they tried it again, and they almost got caught with their hands in the cookie jar when the near pick six, but I think it was Lorenzo Maldon, I want to say, had a chance to catch it and go to the house. And it kind of just speaks to the conservative play calling they've done with Ryan Tannehill the last few weeks. And, you know, give him credit for, I think it's 80 throws or so now that Tannehill has made without throwing an interception, so that's pretty impressive. But the downfield passing game is completely lacking. And when I watched the tape today, you can tell the game plan was to get the Jets run a lot of man coverage, so they wanted to get a lot of mismatches on the linebackers with our running backs and our tight ends, and they did it a lot of the time. The wheel route that Damian Williams ran on that pass by Tannehill that was just perfectly placed in the bucket where he brought the rain with a little touch pass, that was incredible.
Yeah.
And it was a great play call because you see Williams get lined up on the outside linebacker, and he just smokes him. And then throughout the game, Dominic Jones had some linebackers on him and ran some crossing routes, and they took advantage of Calvin Pryor's aggressiveness, because early in the game they were sneaking down to the box and they had no interest in playing the deep. Well, they were playing bump and run on the edges, but with no deep help, and they were committing eight to the box and run blitzing a lot too. So that second play of the game, Dominic Jones got behind the linebackers because they all bit hard on the fake. So it was a great plan in the first half, but I just felt like they went back to it too much in the second half, and they really should have taken more advantage of the Jets creeping into the box and going back with it. And if you look at some of the play actions in the second half, they weren't as aggressive. They were kind of playing off their toes a little bit. I think that kind of helped Ajayi get those 51 yards you mentioned in the fourth quarter. So the first half game plan was awesome. Second half game plan was atrocious, I thought, as bad as he's been this year. So kind of a split grade for Adam Gase calling plays and managing that game. And the last thing I want to say before I get to you with Vance Joseph was the end of the first half clock management. I saw some fans say they didn't have a problem with it, but he had three timeouts going into that drive. They ran three little dump off passes to Ajayi and picked up, I think, 15 or 16 yards on that three play sequence. And he kept all the timeouts in his pocket, or he used one, sorry, and he had two left. And then once they got sacked to make it like 3rd and 24 from their own 41 yard line, there was like 30 seconds left, and he just went into the locker room. And I'm thinking, there's no reason you don't have time to run a 8 to 10 to maybe 15-yard route and pick up some yardage, call a timeout, and then either try a very long field goal or just throw it into the end zone. So not really impressed with that. I'm not sure why he got cold feet there, but it is what it is. And, yeah, a split game for Adam Gase for me.
Yeah, see, I'm kind of the opposite. I thought that was a good time to be conservative just because you take a bad play like that, and I think at that point Kenny Stills was in the locker room because he got sick or whatever happened. I don't know. With the way that the Jets' defense was coming at Tannehill on some of those later drives in the first half, I can't really fault him for that. And then, you know, Andrew Franks, he had a pretty good game, but, I mean, he is what he is. He's very shaky when he's out there. So, you know, I feel like even if you do that, there's more bad outcomes that could have come out of trying to go for it than positive outcomes. So I can't really fault him for that. But, you know, how much do you think, like, you know, between Kenny Stills being gone and Devontae Parker, for whatever reason, just can't seem to get open, how much of that do you think, like, attributed to the dialing back of the game plan, especially the passing game plan in the second half?
I think a pretty fair deal of it, because, or fair amount of it, because they took that shot to Leonte Carew deep, and when you watch it on tape, Tannehill actually anticipates him getting open, and he did this a couple times in this game where he showed good anticipation, and that's what kind of frustrated me with it, was because he was throwing with accuracy, he was showing good footwork in the pocket, and he actually anticipated a few times better than he has all year. And on that Carew long pass, he missed him deep, and I think it's because Carew doesn't have that extra gear that Kenny Stills had, and I think if Stills is on the field, that might have been a touchdown. So, you know, it might have been covered different, it might have been a different play call from the defense, but looking at the way the coverage was, I think they were kind of setting up one of those plays in the second half in that with the first half game plan, and I'm sure he probably had to scrap some of it with Kenny Stills going out. So good point there. I guess I got to add that. So Adam Gase gets a pass in that sense because he lost one of his big playmakers. But one thing that he actually admitted today in his press conference, or maybe it was yesterday, I watched it today, but he said that he kind of shut out Jarvis Landry and he shouldn't have done that. And I agreed, because he threw the ball to Landry four times and he made three catches, and he slipped tackles and juked guys and ran guys over and made a play every single time. And the way their coverage was, they had him open a lot of times, and they were kind of looking off the other side of the coverage, and he was running those little slant and in-cut routes, and he was open, and they were just like foregoing his option there. So I wasn't a fan of that. But Adam Gase, you know, credit to him for admitting that and saying that he made a mistake in that sense too. So I love what Adam Gase is doing, man. He's the coach of the future for this team, and I'm glad we got him.
Yeah, likewise. So ready for a little defense?
Yeah, let's go with the D.
All right. Well, you were talking about Vance Joseph before, and actually, I think this was probably the best called game he's had all season, other than maybe Seattle in week one. You know, I know Miami gave up a bunch of yards on the ground. I went back and rewatched that. You know, Matt Forte had 92 yards on 12 carries. He had 10 carries for 29 yards, and then he broke two big runs, the 31-yard touchdown run, and he had a 32-yard run on a 3rd-and-1 in the game also. So they basically bottled him up, you know, the entire game, other than those two plays. Bilal Powell, you know, had 22 yards on 6 carries. They gave up a few yards to Fitzpatrick scrambling. I went back and watched those two long runs, and the touchdown run, Miami ends up shifting, and Donald Butler, instead of wrong-arming it and getting into the gap, actually tries to shoulder the guy head-on and gets blocked. There's no one back there, and if you watch the All-22 film, I don't know what happened, but there's some sort of miscommunication where Michael Thomas is on the far hash, and he basically backpedals for 10 yards on that play before he even, like, breaks over that way. I don't think he was supposed to be there. He should have been more in the middle of the field. So I think there's an error on that one. And then the second long run, Miami ran kind of a weird shift where they actually played with Spencer Paysinger on the line of scrimmage in a nickel package. And Bakari Rambo came up and tried to fill the hole. He took kind of a poor angle and got blocked. And then Bobby McCain, you know, was on the outside and basically had a bad leverage point and couldn't make the play coming over. So Forte broke a long run there. But I think really they did a pretty nice job of cleaning that up. Altogether on the day, you know, you get 3 sacks, 2 forced fumbles, 2 interceptions. That's a pretty good day at the office. I thought Kiko Alonso probably played his best game of the year.
Yeah, he did.
And then the D-line, I don't know what else to really say about him. You know, Wake had two sacks, two forced fumbles, two tackles for loss in the run game. Jeez. And Ndamukong Suh had that huge stop at the end, plus the sack on Fitzpatrick, basically forced the Jets to punt. Miami was able to run out the clock after that. That won the game for them. And then I actually found a pretty interesting stat today. On our three-game winning streak, Miami's red zone defense, which I thought was pretty impressive against the Jets, has allowed a touchdown just 37.5% of the time over the last three games on all opportunities. That's actually fourth best in the NFL over that stretch. And surprisingly, throughout the whole season, they've allowed a touchdown on 52.2% of the red zone opportunities, which is actually 13th in the NFL. And it's kind of surprising to say it just because of how poorly Miami started, but they're actually top half in points allowed, top half in yards allowed, top 10 in pass defense. And really the only bad number we have is rush defense allowed in terms of total yards and yards per carry. But we've been getting better at that, I think, over the win streak. And then I think the other thing he did a really nice job of was he took away the Jets' weapons. You know, I think we talked about it in the preview show that we couldn't let Brandon Marshall and Quincy and Nunua have big days and get yards after catch. Combined, they went seven catches for 70 yards. Marshall had 6 for 45. Anunua had 1 for 25. They stopped Bilal Powell and Matt Forte out of the backfield pretty well. Just 5 catches for 34 yards. I mean, if Ryan Fitzpatrick was going to beat Miami throwing to the Anderson kid and Jalen Marshall, you know, hats off to them. But kudos to Vance Joseph for taking those guys away. And, you know, really, that was just a good, fun game, entertaining to watch. Again, I think some of the untimely penalties hurt Miami. You know, we had a chance to go 3-and-out on the opening drive. Jelani Jenkins got a pass interference on the drive where Matt Forte had the touchdown run. We had the Jets in a 3rd-and-long. Andre Branch gets called for a horse collar, even though if he just regularly tackled Brandon Marshall, we would have been off the field.
Yeah.
So that's 10 points right there. We basically gave the Jets. Plus we had the Matt Darr drop snap on the punt, whatever that was. Put the Jets in automatic field goal range. They ended up scoring a touchdown on that. And I think I saw you posted on the Fins that, you know, Michael Thomas, again, I think did something wrong there in coverage because Bobby McCain played that with outside leverage and Michael Thomas was in the middle of the field along with Abdul Kaddous. So I feel like Miami can clean up some things and they probably win that game by a lot more. But those are my thoughts on the defense for the day.
Yeah, and you mentioned all the penalties and mistakes they made. It seems like it's been that way for the last three games. Like, I mean, the Pittsburgh game was closer than it should have been. The Buffalo game was much closer than it should have been. Mm-hmm. And then you said the same thing with this game. And you kind of alluded to Jelani Jenkins having a pass interference call. One of the notes I had written down for you was he was my goat in this game. I thought he was out of position. He was slow to react. He couldn't get to the sidelines quick enough. And how did you feel about Jelani Jenkins' performance in this game?
Yeah, I kind of had that thought just watching it live on Sunday, and then I rewatched it today. He actually played probably the best game in terms of run defense that he's played all season. His passing defense was not very good. I don't think there's really much of a drop-off when Spencer Paysinger came into the game after Jenkins broke his hand or whatever happened there. But I just have to give my goat to Michael Thomas. And you know, interestingly enough, Bakari Rambo, who first game with the team, actually played more snaps than Michael Thomas, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's a trend that continues. But, you know, Jenkins, I think altogether we're better with him off the field as much as you can keep him off the field. But to his credit, he did play the run pretty well and had a couple nice stops, especially in the first half.
Yeah, and you mentioned that Bakari Rambo came in and played pretty well or played more snaps at least than Michael Thomas. And I read that Rashad Jones kind of coached him up a little bit because their teammates back at the time in Georgia. So apparently he had some things to help him out with, and that's nice to hear. It'll be interesting to see what they do with the lineup going forward. And speaking of lineup changes, now that we have the offensive line back together for the last three games, the unicorn line, as our favorite beat writer Omar Kelly dubbed them, they're looking awesome, man. I'm going to get to the O-line here a little bit and talk about how kind of good and bad of a day they had. And, you know, we had talked about this in the preview show about how the Jets defensive line is as strong of a unit as there is in the NFL, and whether or not they're playing in unison or playing together or happy with their current situation. I know Sheldon Richardson's not too thrilled about his contract situation up there, but it doesn't necessarily mean they don't have talent because they have that in, you know, spades. So I kind of wrote a note down for all these offensive linemen, what I saw from the film. And you know, Juwan James, I thought, played his best game of the year in this one. His pass protection was pretty solid. He had good pass protection. He was confused on a couple of stunts, and he was, I guess, partially responsible for a sack. He had a penalty in the game as well, but his run blocking, him and Jermon Bushrod both had some similar struggles early in the game with some run blocking. But on that final drive, they were burying guys. And I don't know if that's a result of just the guys being worn down or kind of quitting on the team, but Bushrod and James were destroying people at the end of the game. And speaking of Jermon Bushrod, he's either outhouse or castle, is a term I once heard, in terms of his run blocking. It's either atrocious or absolutely gorgeous. He can get to the second level, and he can open a lane that's the size of, you know, of Florida, if you will. And when he gets it right, he gets it right, man. And those two guys just got it done that last drive. Mike Pouncey, I wrote down, he is incredible. He is making me eat my words right now, because I thought he was not a special player as everyone kind of thought he was, but he's playing really well. The line adjustments that they're making look so much better with him out there. They're handling the stunts. Guys are quicker to their assignments. He's been a wall in pass protection and making some key blocks in the running game. He did have some bad snaps. I had him down for two snaps out of three against Leonard Williams, where Williams just kind of schooled him. And that's going to happen, but for the most part, he played pretty well. Just a good game from Pouncey again. And then Laramie Tunzel had some struggles early on in the game. He kind of had an up-and-down game as well. He struggles with some power sometimes. Jarvis Jenkins and Steve McClendon both kind of bullied him on that first drive on some of those Ajayi negative runs. But I don't know if it's coaching or just Tunzel being a heck of a player, but he got some things corrected, and you could see him kind of widen his stance on some pass blocking and getting more drive in the run blocking game. And he's just phenomenal in the open field. And he bounced back in the second half and played better, I thought. So good on him for getting some adjustments made and making the right corrections. And then Brandon Albert played, I thought, his best game of the year as well. He was awesome in pass protection. There was no problems in pass protection from Albert, Tunzel, and Pouncey in this game throughout the entire game. They didn't really have any pressures. All the pressures came from the right side. I had him down for one negative play where he got beaten pass protection, but other than that, absolutely stellar. He had a huge dig-out block on a lengthy Ajayi run, so great from him on that standpoint. And then I guess tight ends kind of mixed into the run blocking as well. And guess who had another huge block on the Ajayi touchdown run? My super secret star himself. If you go to Wright Travis Wright on WelcomeToPerfectville.com, I wrote an article last week calling Marquise Gray our secret superstar, kind of stealing a term from, I think it's Pro Football Focus that uses that term. But Gray has been so sensational in this aspect and getting the run game going. He had an outstanding seal block on the edge on, I think it was a linebacker, to open a hole for Jay Ajayi in the touchdown run. So another good game from him. He had some missed blocks, but for the most part, I thought he played pretty well. Dominic Jones had a huge game up until that drop on the crucial third down. That was just egregious. Would have extended the drive, would have not had Matt Darr punting or attempting to punt, I suppose. So he looked pretty good. He got some good work against man coverage. If you notice the touchdown play on the second touchdown, Tannehill's touchdown pass, they trusted Dominic Jones to go out there and beat a guy in man coverage, and he did. He ran a good out route, and Tannehill put the ball right where he had to be. And then at the very last drive of the game on third, and I think it was three, where the pass interference got thrown, they trusted Jones again to win another out route against another linebacker, and he did. He got to the edge on there. So
good for a big dude, he's got some pretty soft hands other than the one drop he had.
He does. I listened to Perfectville today, or Welcome to Perfectville with Sam and Chris, you know, the main podcast for our website, and they mentioned that he was playing indoor football and sleeping on his coach's couch, and he didn't have a place, like his own place, and he was trying to just scrape by playing indoor football. So that's a pretty crazy story. Good for him. His first career touchdown. Played a good game. So that's my boys in the trenches. Is there anything you want to follow up on that? Or?
No, I think I was pretty happy with the offense, all things considered. You know, no turnovers. What do we run for? About a buck 40, I think, everyone combined on the number one run defense in football.
Yeah, it's not bad.
You know, and I thought it was pretty inspiring that Gase actually stuck with the run into the fourth quarter. You know, I don't think Joe Philbin or Bill Lazor or Dan Campbell would have done that. So, you know, kudos to them for that. And it was great to get a win over the Jets.
Yeah, it really is. And without the benefit of a passing game, too, and the receivers in this game, they struggled as well, I thought. You know, Kenny Stills, like you mentioned, he went out early in the game. He only had 15 snaps, so he didn't play the second half. I still didn't figure out what his illness was, but you could see his impact on the game was definitely missed, even though he wasn't visible throughout most of the first half. He had one nice catch, but Landry, like I said, the three catches on the four targets. He had a slant route, Landry did. I think it was his first catch where he bent it to the outside and cut it back in, and the DB got turned around and just looked embarrassing. I also had a good note or a note about how the coaching staff or the sideline made a great play when Landry had that nice run up the sideline and got pushed out of bounds. And you see him pop up like he does, and he's going to get in someone's face and start chirping and probably get a foul. You see like five Dolphins assistants and staff members getting around Landry and just congratulate him so he can't get himself in trouble. So it's exciting to see that.
Rizzy got over there.
Yeah, he's kind of like the get back guy, isn't he? Isn't Darren Rizzy that?
Yeah. That guy. He's something.
Here's something I wanted to ask you about. It's offense, but I think we both need to kind of hit on it because it's a big deal, and we are both expecting such big things out of him. And on the Perfect Field podcast today, Sam had mentioned this is his worst player ever. They do a worst player ever segment where they talk about which player was the worst in the game, and he chose Devontae Parker, and I'm inclined to agree with him because Parker, I had him down for four targets, and they were all manufactured to him within the scheme. He's not winning coverage battles. He's not winning one-on-ones. They're trying to throw him quick slants or quick screens or, you know, little quick bubble screens or whatever it is. They're getting the ball quickly, and he's not having to do anything. And you had mentioned last week that he professed himself to Rishard Matthews last year that he struggles getting off the line when he's not stacked behind another receiver. So this is a guy that's looking slow out of breaks. I don't know if it's his hamstring or what it is, but he can't separate, man. He's costing this offense valuable routes, if you will, because a lot of these routes clear out certain plays, and he runs some clear out routes. That's about all he's good for right now. So what do we do with Devontae Parker, man? Is he going to kind of wear this offense down for the rest of the year? Do we go to Leonte Carew? What do you think we should do there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a twofold problem. And I guess just to be clear, when I brought that up about the mic'd up, you know, he said he felt better when he was stacked back or lined up off the ball. You know, not that he struggled getting off the ball against press, okay. But, you know, I think you can kind of infer that. So not to get that misconstrued, but, you know, just I think it's kind of a two-part problem. You know, I don't think he's got that sort of like elite quickness that you see out of like AJ Green or Larry Fitzgerald or someone who's, you know, kind of a similar build. And at the same time, I think Tannehill is one of those guys where, you know, if you can get open consistently, he trusts you. I don't know if Tannehill quite trusts Devontae Parker to try and, you know, throw him open or throw him some of those, you know, plays where he's basically covered and you have to rely on the receiver to make the catch. It's just one of those things where, you know, I hope Sean Jefferson's able to work with him. But, you know, at this point, you know, I was actually talking about it with my friend from Wisconsin today. You know, at this point, I'm almost inclined to try and keep the unicorn offensive line in place, even bringing back Jermon Bushrod just because of how well they're playing. And I'd almost be more inclined to bring back Kenny Stills now at this point, just because he at least offers you a deep threat and can kind of get some of the safeties to back off the line of scrimmage. And I don't want to say trade Devontae Parker, but I mean, it's just, I don't know. I'd like to see him succeed over the last eight games before, you know, succeed or fail before I make a decision on it. But he struggles so much at getting himself as open as Tannehill probably needs him to be is where I'll leave it.
And I'm with you on the offensive line. I think there's something to be said about some cohesion that can be developed over the course of time. You see a lot of these good offensive lines spend years together, and they develop a rhythm that they play together really well. So I'm with you on that. I think Jermon Bushrod's playing well enough to earn his keep around here for sure. And then you got the superstar Tunzel and Pouncey, and Albert's playing well, man. If these guys stay healthy, we're going to be a tough team to beat down the stretch. In regards to Kenny Stills, I agree. I think he does a lot for this offense. But it kind of opens up a point that I wanted to bring up and how I think that this passing game just it has to get going in order for this miracle run that we're going to make. If we're going to make it, it's going to have to happen through the passing game because the running game is what it is. The defense can struggle at times, but if we can get some big shot plays, one or two shot plays a game, and get some chunk yardage as well, this offense can really take off and start scoring a lot of points because right now they're the 27th scoring offense in the league, and that's not going to get it done. I know there's a lot of the early games that are kind of wearing down on that, but you know, the plan being with the kind of misdirection and some play action and some of these crackback tight ends across the formation they're doing, it works well, but it also should open up some opportunities from one-on-one coverages down the field. And there was one play where Tannehill had Parker deep in man coverage, and the DB was kind of flat-footed, and Tannehill checked off and didn't go to him. So I think you're right with that trust factor. I think it's not quite there with him right now. It seemed like it was last year, but perhaps, you know, there's some bad practice habits that are spewing over onto the game day field for Devontae Parker. And Speaking of Ryan Tannehill, we got to talk about him again because we're checking our boxes here. And you had mentioned to me that you didn't think he checked the box in this game.
No, I don't think he did. So far I've got him at 1.5 out of 3. I gave him a solid check against Pittsburgh, hesitant check against Buffalo. For me, you know, the second half, what was he in the game? Like 4 of 12?
Yeah, not
good. I think in the second half passing, just really couldn't get things going. And, you know, he had a couple easy throws, like the throw to Landry, he threw it in the dirt. He had two little slip screens. I think one got deflected, and then there was the one that you talked about earlier that almost got picked off by Maldon. You know, just the quick horizontal passing game needs to be scrapped. Like, he's not good at it unless there's off coverage. Like, I know he had the one to Landry, which I think was the sideline play you talked about where he just threw him a little smoke route.
He did. Did you watch the Seattle-Buffalo game on Monday?
I watched most of it, yeah.
The way Russell Wilson kind of arcs those balls over the free rusher on those little design play-action bootlegs, Tannehill needs to watch that because his throws are always from weird arm angles and they're not getting over that guy. So I'm with you on that. We should scrap those plays that are kind of side, you know, lateral throws.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give him credit. He took more hits in this game than he has the past 2 weeks combined.
Yep.
I mean, the Jets have a great defensive line. You know, it sucks to admit that, but they do. I thought I give him credit for not turning it over, but, I mean, that, you know, if you're in the playoffs and you've got to go to New England or go to Oakland or Kansas City, you know, one of those places where they've got a really good defense all around and can get after you, that's just not going to win football games. So I did not give him a check this week.
That's fair. I think I'm a little bit more up on his performance than you were. You haven't 1.5 checks. I'm going to give him 2 checks. I gave him not a check for the Buffalo game, but I did give him 1 for this game. And I think it's similar to where we differ in terms of Adam Gase's play calling. I think he really dialed it back and didn't give Tannehill much of a chance to succeed. Now, the opposition would argue that he's doing that because he doesn't trust Ryan Tannehill, and Ryan Tannehill's not capable of doing that. But here's a misleading stat for you, because I don't think it's prevalent, but I'm going to say it anyways. Ryan Tannehill's passer rating over the last 3 games is 94.5, which is better than Russell Wilson and Andrew Luck, and equal to Derek Carr's passer rating in that same stretch. So a lot of guys that get a lot of praise, and Tannehill's right there in terms of quarterback rating, or I should say passer rating, not the ESPN QBR stat. So, you know, I gave him a positive check mark. Like I said, I want to see him take some more shots down the field. He's in command of the huddle right now. I like that. I like some of the shifts they're doing where they come out in heavy sets, like the touchdown to Dominic Jones, where they came out with 3 tight ends and they were heavy and then they shift out wide and Tannehill kind of takes control of that. He did check to the Ajayi touchdown run. He had a formation he liked and he checked to it. So, you know, good on him for that, for getting them in, out of a bad play into a good one. And then a couple more offensive notes that I had was just 2 little quick one-liners. Damian Williams, for me, is carving out a nice role on this team as a third down back and a kind of a spell back, that Travis Minor to Ricky Williams role, if you will, from back in the day. And speaking of back in the day, we're going to have a segment for you guys later on in the show, so get ready for that one. But Damian Williams is looking good as a runner. He looks even better as a pass catcher for me. And then Kenyon Drake on that swing pass that he caught that I mentioned. Big fan of the way he looks running the ball. I wouldn't mind seeing him get some more carries. He had just, 3 snaps in this game offensively. And I wouldn't mind seeing that role expand just a bit because I don't think Ajayi is going to be able to continue going with 46 snaps in this game again. He's really been a workhorse for us. So wouldn't mind seeing the running back lion's share get divvied up a little bit more.
Okay. Yeah, and I think just kind of one final note on me for the defense. I feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Jordan Phillips with the interception and then the hurdle heard around the world on that play. You know, I thought Jordan Phillips probably played his best game, and if not for Ndamukong Suh, I'd probably say he was the best player Miami had on defense in that game. You know, he was walking back James Carpenter, the Jets' left guard, who's a big, strong dude, walking him back pretty consistently. He fought off a double team for a TFL early in the game. You know, he gets some nice pressure when he gets moving. And, you know, I think Barry Jackson said it, and it was someone else posted it on the Fins this morning that, you know, a couple defensive players believe he's getting ready to break out if he can just kind of keep that consistent level of play. You know, I think we kind of really saw it against the Jets on Sunday, and man, that was sweet to see a 6'6", 335-pound nose tackle drop into a short zone, get a pick, and and make a pretty impressive play.
And then he gets up and spikes the ball, which probably went down through the earth because he spiked the ball with so much velocity. And then you see the entire sideline come down there and congratulate him. That was so cool to see. These guys are really playing well together and inspired together. And it's fun to see him having fun out there because, you know, it's fun for us as fans when they're playing like this. And it's fun to see them enjoying it. So definitely agree that Jordan Phillips seems to be coming along. And I read a thing that I think it was on the Fins, a little little quote about how somebody mentioned that he's been shadowing Ndamukong Suh, almost obsessing over Ndamukong Suh and trying to learn how to be a better professional and learn how to be as dominant as Suh is. And, man, if we get that from him, if we get that Nick Fairley from 2014 production that he gave in Detroit, this defense, the ceiling is the sky's the limit with the way that they can play up front because those guys command so much attention inside that it's easy for those guys like Cam Wick to rush the outside. So, yeah, Phillips is really looking awesome right now. I hope it continues because we could really use him taking on blocks for Suh in the middle and then just kind of ripple effect that it has building the middle out from the defense. So that brings us – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that. That's kind of the consistent level of play, I think, is going to help when we get Earl Mitchell back. And I thought that was kind of a nice little segue into our roster housekeeping notes, if you want to go ahead there.
That's exactly where I was going. So I'm glad you're 9 episodes in now? We're starting to read each other's minds. That's not too bad.
It's a little scary.
Good deal. So, for the roster housekeeping, we mentioned it earlier in the show, but Chris Culliver has been activated. I'm sure if you guys watched the game last night, it was scrolling across the bottom of the screen on ESPN all night. He's activated. And then Chris Jones and Chimdi Chekwa have both been given their release. They're gone off the squad now. And Lafayette Pitts has been called up from the practice squad. And I see the name Lafayette Pitts. It's kind of a funny name. And I remember seeing his name on there in the preseason training camp roster. And I was kind of like, who is this guy? So I got a chance to look at him a little bit. And then that Giants game, the first preseason game, he had, to me, what was the best play of any Dolphin this year, best individual effort, where he ran a tip drill and swatted the ball back inbounds to A.J. Hendy, also on the practice squad, who intercepted it. And so I'm excited to see if he can get on the field, maybe contribute on special teams, and then maybe hopefully break up a little bit of this logjam at cornerback, because that kind of reminds me of another question I had for you, Kevin, if you don't mind, is one of the guys that's kind of been, he's kind of been a polarizing figure the last few weeks, especially after this Jets game, with the way he handled Brandon Marshall. But Byron Maxwell, I think you had mentioned he only allowed 4 catches for 60 yards or something, or 6 catches for 60 yards in that range. And that looks good on paper. And I'm one of the guys that doesn't believe in that solid performance because he had, 3-4 penalties on Brandon Marshall in that game. So what are your thoughts on Byron Maxwell moving forward and keeping his job with Xavier Howard and Chris Culliver coming back?
Yeah, so I guess first you spoke about the logjam at corner. The Dolphins did make one more move late today. They waived B'nai Benwickery, another corner. So he's off the roster. And I think that opens up a spot that will most likely be filled by Earl Mitchell if they activate him off IR this week. With Maxwell, I think that's kind of been Vance Joseph's thing, is where he, if someone's not playing up to snuff, he kind of puts them in the doghouse. You know, he did it to Mario Williams earlier this year. He did it to Maxwell when they benched him for the Cincinnati game. I don't think he got the start against the Browns the following week either. Or, excuse me, the week before, or the Titans the week after the Bengals game. He did it to Jordan Phillips. Jordan Phillips goes out and, doing his best Michael Jordan impersonation. With Maxwell, I thought he was just brilliant against the Steelers when they played Antonio Brown. I think Brown had something like 5 catches for 40-some yards. And then against Brandon Marshall, I think, Marshall was pretty keyed up for that game, and he had talked about how much Maxwell holds and was grabbing jerseys and stuff leading up to it. And, there was one pass interference penalty that was pretty blatant where he grabbed Marshall's arm, but I think for the most part, he basically took Marshall out of the game. And, for Marshall to have, I think, 6 catches for 45 yards, that's less than 8 a catch. I'll take that. Every corner is probably going to get a pass interference penalty in this day and age. I think right now he's just kind of playing on a really good run these last 3 games. I don't know if he's going to be on the roster after this season, because I don't know if the contract he's on now, I don't know if he's quite justifying that level of pay, but he's on a hot streak these past 3 games. We'll see if it continues when we play San Diego, just because you know, Phil Rivers just gets the ball out so quick, and that might be kind of a bugaboo for Maxwell.
Yeah, he really does. I got a chance to watch a little bit of their offense today on tape, too. We'll get to that in a minute. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Maxwell. And I mean, and Tony Lippett's playing so well on the other side that it's kind of hard to take him out of the game, too. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when those guys get back and healthy. But that's a bridge for another day, I suppose. And kind of looking at the way things stack up in the AFC right now, the Dolphins are currently sitting at 7th in the AFC at 4-4, with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 teams below them that are either 4-4 or 4-5. And one of those teams, the team that's also 4-4, is Pittsburgh, who, when they came into the game against Miami, were 4-1, probably the favorites to have a chance to beat the Patriots in the AFC to go to the Super Bowl. They've lost 3 in a row. They're faltering. The Ravens are in the lead in the AFC North. Denver looks lost the last few weeks offensively, and their defense isn't playing as well without Aqib Talib either. The Bills' loss helped the Dolphins out, and then San Diego game helped us out too by taking down Tennessee and putting them below us in the standings too. So the Dolphins had a pretty good Sunday. It's going to come down to Kansas City and Denver. I think one of them has to falter. You and me had touched on this briefly today via text. Denver, I think, is probably our best bet if you look at the remaining schedule. So
yeah, they have a really rough schedule. They play at New Orleans, who's kind of the NFC equivalent of the Dolphins right now. They're on a hot streak. They're 4-4. They still have to play Kansas City twice.
Yep.
They play New England, and they still have another game against Oakland left on the schedule. So, and they also play Tennessee, who's been running the ball pretty well, and Denver really hasn't stopped the run as well as they did last year on their Super Bowl run. So,
exactly.
I think if any team's going to fall back right now, I'd put my money on Denver. And it was just nice for a change to have one weekend where the Dolphins actually got a lot of breaks, because we have tiebreakers in hand over Pittsburgh, Buffalo, and the Jets now. Tennessee lost. If we can kind of get some distance between them and Cincinnati, since they've got head-to-heads over Miami, you know, that would be big. So, you know, there's a couple teams we've got to root for this coming week. I know the Giants play the Bengals. That's one of them. But we take on San Diego, so we can kind of help ourselves out a little bit. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next month or so.
Yeah, absolutely. And you look at the standings right now. I have it pulled up right now, looking at the conference records. And the Dolphins, every team below them doesn't have 4 conference wins. We have 4 AFC conference wins. The Chiefs are 5-2 in conference. The Broncos are 4-2. So we're right there with the Broncos at 4 with 4 wins in conference. So that's the tiebreaker that comes down to when you don't have a head-to-head game, and we don't play either of those teams this year. And kind of my sentiment, I've been preaching on the Dolphins forums and everything the last couple of weeks, is if we get to 10-6, I think we'll make it in, because someone's going to falter. And like you said, I think it's Denver, but I think 10-6 will do it. And that 10-6 is absolutely vital that we get the win this weekend in San Diego, which brings us into our next little segment. We're going to go ahead and look at the San Diego game just briefly, because I kind of didn't have as much chance to look at it as I would have liked to, but I did get a chance to watch them on offense. Did you get a chance to watch their defense at all?
I did, just basically the Tennessee game they played on Sunday, but that's about it.
Okay, that's the one I watched as well. So I just put some notes down here, and I'll just kind of rattle off through them real quick if you don't mind. You mentioned that Rivers gets the ball out so quickly, and he does, and he's really a precision surgeon-like when it comes to running this offense. He's been in the offense for however many years. He's kind of like Tom Brady in the sense that it's his offense, not really the coaching staff's offense that he runs down there. He's in shotgun about 90% of the time, and he likes to look at his numbers and get his reads from there. He kind of does what the Dolphins offense does and dictates based off what the defense is showing. He'll kind of do, you know, the opposite, if you will. And he gets the ball out so quickly and anticipates so well. He kind of puts the ball in a spot where the receiver is supposed to be. And these guys are all so well tuned into the game plan that they wind up getting there. And by the time they get there, the ball's getting there. And it's very difficult to defend. The Titans had problems with it all day. Every team in the league is having problems with it so far this year, as the Chargers offense is clicking. Melvin Gordon has a billion touchdown runs this year after having 0 last year. He's running very hard. And you're going to have to flow to the ball and wrap him up, because his pad level is better this year, his balance is better, and he's getting through tackles better this year. So very key to stop him in this game. Blitz beaters, they are great at. They like to get the ball out quickly. Their receivers are underrated, man. Dontrell Inman and Tyrell Williams, they can beat one-on-one coverage quickly and within 2 seconds of the snap, and it's important for them because they get those blitz beaters, and they throw it to them. Those guys catch it and run it all over the place. And then the last guy that I had on here was Hunter Henry, who our linebackers have struggled this year, probably outside of Kiko Alonso in coverage. they've struggled, and I don't know what the plan's going to be for covering Hunter Henry, but someone's going to need to do that and take him out of the game because he could have a big game against us. And, yeah, that's all I got from the Chargers offense.
Yeah, for their defense, I know one note, someone posted today that they thought Hunter Henry may not even play against Miami. I guess he got hurt at some point in the Tennessee game for them, so that's something to keep an eye on this week.
That would be fantastic.
Just looking at them, really the best part of their defense is their run defense. They're fifth in the league. I think we just proved that we can basically run the ball on anybody as long as we keep at it. One of the notes I had is they play a 3-4. Their interior three is basically a brick wall. It's a lot like the Jets. They have Corey Legit, who's always been a pretty good player. They signed Brandon Mebane to play in the middle. He's just an absolute brick house. And then Damian Square, one of those Alabama guys that, you know, was drafted late or undrafted, that still, you know, 6'4", 300 pounds, and just another brick house. The one note I did get is, and I've seen this as sort of an Ohio State fan myself, you can run right at Joey Bosa. Our old pal Anthony Fasano is one of the tight ends for Tennessee, and there were quite a few plays where Bosa either just basically stones him so neither of them are moving, or Fasano put him on the ground two or three times. You know, it'll be hard to run outside of him because he does play very well laterally, and he's got long arms and really strong hands. But if you can run right at him and kind of make some of those inside zone cuts off him, I think Jay Ajayi can have some success that way. I think we'll be able to run at Melvin Ingram, their other outside linebacker. They're inconsistent in terms of getting pressure. I think they have to blitz quite a bit. You know, Bosa is doing pretty well. He's probably their best pass rusher just in terms of getting pressures. But they actually have fewer sacks than Miami. I think they have 17 or 18 sacks in one more game played than we do. They do generate a lot of turnovers. They are second in the league in interceptions with 11. They are tied, I think it was for third or fourth in the league with 10 forced fumbles. They've recovered 7 of those, so 18 turnovers so far. So basically Miami's got to keep doing what they're doing and protect the ball. On third downs, like I said, they kind of have to manufacture their pass rush, so they have a lot of just funky-looking packages. They'll play that radar-type defense where there's no down linemen. They'll have like 5 linebackers up at the line of scrimmage, and they'll rush 4, or they'll rush 3 and bring, you know, safeties and corners from all over. Tennessee kind of got behind early in the game, so I don't think they could run the ball as much as they wanted to. One thing Tennessee did have success with was kind of spreading them out, trying to get them into nickel looks and running on them, and then they hit Rishard Matthews in the slot quite a bit in that game. Brandon Flowers and their other corner, whose name escapes me right now,
Casey Hayward,
are both pretty good on the perimeter. But I think it was Steve Williams and Craig Major, their nickel and dime guys. They weren't too good. So I would say this game you're going to have to feed Jarvis Landry against them, and then just stick with the run, stay ahead of the chain, stay on schedule, don't turn the ball over, and you know, just basically keep Phillip Rivers off the field. Would be my strategy with the Chargers.
And that alludes perfectly into my next point, was how the best way to beat a good quarterback is to keep him off the field. And looking at the drive chart for the Dolphins last week, they had a drive of 6 plays for 75 yards that took 3.5 minutes off the clock, 11 plays for 75 yards again that took 5 minutes 19 seconds, 6 plays, 27, 3:13, 5 plays for 8, 1:14 in the first half. And then they came back out in the second half with a 10-play drive that was only good for a field goal, but it was 56 yards and took another 5 minutes off the clock. And that's kind of why we're winning these games, because Ajayi's wearing on these teams and leaning on them like a heavyweight fighter is, and they just get knocked out in the end of the game. So that's probably got to be the mold for the Chargers. You know, the Chargers have struggled with the Chiefs in the past. I think our offense is kind of looking like the Chiefs with Andy Reid has been in the last couple of years with Alex Smith. You know, Tannehill has similar qualities. He spreads the ball around. We had 8 receivers catch passes on Sunday, so that's beneficial for us there. But I do agree with you in getting Jarvis Landry the ball. I think he needs to have one of those 10-12 catch games here for us to win this one, and I think he should be able to kind of get some running room in the secondary there. Just going over some of the season stats now for the Dolphins offense this year, they are 29th in Sorry, let me start that over. 29th in yards per game passing offense, but they are 7th in yards per pass. So pretty big discrepancy there. sixth in yards per game rushing offense, but second in yards per carry at 4.9, only behind Buffalo. And they are the 20th ranked scoring offense. I think I said 29th earlier. They are 20th ranked scoring offense at 21.6 points per game. So it's important to get that running game going. It's the Chargers, like you said, and keeping Philip Rivers off the field. And I agree with you. What is your game prediction for this game, Kevin?
I'd probably like to watch another Chargers game, but I think if Miami can, you know, stick with the running game, I'll go 23-20. I think Miami's got a better chance. I feel better about this one than I did Buffalo.
We were kind of talking about that last week with the Jets, too, how you were kind of worried about that game, and I felt better about the Jets game and worried about this Chargers game. I think there's something to be said about going on the road for the first time after a 45-day stint at home, especially all the way across the country. These guys are professionals. They'll get it taken care of, but I just think that Rivers in the end is going to be too much to handle. I'm going to go with 26-23 San Diego. Hope I'm wrong. I have been many times in the past with this team because you never know, but that's my prediction for the game. And then Kevin and I wanted to introduce a new segment that we're hoping sticks as a full-time thing, at least the idea of the segment. I'm not sure what the name or my little drop I'm going to play here for you guys, but we didn't decide on a name yet. I'm thinking maybe we'll just kind of keep that open for now. If you aren't a fan of South Park or don't watch South Park, you're not going to know what this is, but we're going to go with it anyways. We're kind of having nostalgic feelings. I was telling Kevin that I was watching some Ricky Williams footage this weekend and just kind of thinking back to my adolescence and watching Ricky run all over the Jets and other teams across the NFL. So I got my member berries from South Park, which if you have watched that show. And if you remember Ricky Williams, you certainly remember Jamie Nails, which is my remember player of the week. I don't even know if that makes sense, but that's what we're going to go with for now on that segment. I remember Jamie Nails because he was left guard of that team, and he was pretty much Laramie Tunsil that year in terms of pulling and getting out and road grading and killing people in the running game, and just had an awesome season. And it was too bad that injuries really derailed his season or his career after that 2002 season. He was never really the same again. But for me, I remember watching him with that big old neck roll and the big thigh pads and just getting out there and brutalizing guys back in the old school style of football that was allowed back in the early 2000s. So my player that I am nostalgic and remembering today is Jamie Nails. Kevin, do you got one for me?
Yeah, and I'm actually going to mix it up. I'm going to go with an offensive player in honor of all the unknown tight ends we've seemed to be rolling out with, you know, Dominique Jones, Marquise Gray, Thomas Duarte. I'm going to give you Jed Weaver, who was with the Dolphins from 2000 to 2002. Probably the most significant thing he had was he caught the game-tying touchdown in that wild card game against the Colts.
Yes, he did. I love that.
The day Lamar Smith went wild, he caught the game-tying touchdown to send it to overtime. But I always just remember him as being, you know, a tough blocker. He would never really get many passes thrown his way, you know, sort of the way that Jones and Gray, you know, have kind of been this year. I actually got to meet him one time down in Florida when I was actually working at Jason Taylor's camp, and sat down and talked to him for about 20 minutes, and, you know, probably 15 of that was talking about that playoff game with the Colts. And just a pretty cool dude, real nice guy, really approachable, and I was just kind of remembered him as one of those lunch pail type players. And, you know, he knew his role, he played his role well, and, you know, helped Miami get a playoff win. And if I can remember right, I think that is our last playoff win, isn't it?
I was just going to say, I think, Kevin, you nailed that segment because that was our last playoff win, and you probably just brought back tons of nostalgic feelings for all the Dolphins fans listening. And thank you guys again for listening. If you are listening, please tweet me or Kevin and give us an idea of what we should call that segment. I am at Travis_Wrights. He is at KevinMD4 on Twitter, and we would like to keep that segment going, and next week we'll give you two more players. For now, that's the end of that segment. But I wanted to bring up one last thing. Well, I guess we have two more things we're going to get to, but one thing in terms of the just general NFL feel that I wanted to touch on, and that was kind of watching the last two primetime games, the Seattle-Buffalo and the Oakland-Denver game. And I noticed that a lot of the Raiders' offense, and this has a lot to do with the fact that Michael Crabtree and Amari Cooper are just studs on the outside with Seth Roberts in the slot, they are throwing all these pop flies, and they either run under it and catch it a decent amount of the time, but they're also getting tons of pass interference calls. And Russell Wilson did the same thing last night. And it kind of made me wonder, why aren't the Dolphins having this built into the offense where they just kind of throw up these 50-50 balls? Because with how flag happy the league is today, I mean, you can get some free yardage out of it and some free first downs. Like, the Seahawks had a first and 25 last night, and they just chucked it into the end zone and got a pass interference, and there you go, first and goal at the one. So that kind of led me and Kevin in talking about potential rule changes we'd like to see moving forward in the NFL. And I had one that I guess I didn't explain to you very well today because I couldn't really define what they were. But my rule change would be on pass interference calls. I don't like the college's rule or college football's rule, and I don't like the NFL's rule either. I want a mix of those. And what I would do is institute a rule where you have intermediate and severe pass interference, where intermediate is either a 5 or a 10 yard penalty or something like that. And I guess it could be an automatic first down, maybe not. I'm open to whatever. But then you have a severe penalty where it's a spot foul, where you get the ball at the spot of the foul. And the way Kevin was asking me, well, how do you determine that? I'm just thinking, if you can tell the guy's maliciously going after the guy, he's beat and he's trying to, you know, bring him down to prevent a big play, that's a malicious, severe pass interference. Whereas if you get tangled or you're kind of hand fighting and they're going to throw a flag, that would be more of the intermediate flag. So, Kevin, any thoughts on that further than what we talked about earlier today?
I think it works just as long as you kind of define what it is, even though you're kind of putting it subjectively into the official's hands, which after the game last night and the debacle of the Bills field goal before the first half, which I loved seeing Rex Ryan go ballistic, because I can't really stand Rex Ryan, even though I think he's a great defensive coach. But, I mean, that was just a mess. And I really think the NFL needs full-time officials, you know, that get paid year-round. The NFL is the only major sport that doesn't have that. So I'd like to see that change. As far as the pass interference rule goes, you know, I think if it's more than like 10 yards downfield, I think it should be the malicious type or a spot foul. And if it's under 10 yards, you know, make it a 10 or 15 yard penalty and, you know, you get a first down out of it or something like that. And I know we talked about my rule change, and mine was actually going to be to eliminate illegal contact, or if many people don't remember this, but it's actually Peyton Manning's rule. He lobbied for it after all those AFC championship games when the Colts would get mugged by Troy Brown playing corner and Ty Law and all those guys for the Patriots. I would just change it and make it to where, you know, there's no 5 yard limit. If, as long as the ball isn't in the air, a DB should be allowed to hand check you and hand fight you. Just to make the game a little bit tougher. I think there's too many pass interference calls as it is. Illegal contact is such a brutal penalty because it's 5 yards, but it's an automatic first down.
Yeah.
I just don't like that rule. I think the DBs should have more of a fair chance to be physical. So that's my rule change.
I think every fan of the game would like to see less flags and have it more cleaned up and have the officials be full-time and just kind of get some calls right, because it's been tough, you know, from that standpoint, and the ratings dip, everyone's talking about that and how the flags are having an impact, whatever. I'm still going to watch the games, but there's things they can do to clean it up. So I'm with you there. And then lastly, we were doing this, you know, a few episodes back when the Dolphins were struggling, but I kind of want to get back into it because Kevin and I are both kind of draft nuts and we like to watch a lot of college football. And I've been obsessed with college football this year in particular, more so than any one I ever have in the past, I think. And one of the teams I've been watching a lot is Michigan. And they have a player that I think could really come in and impact this offense immediately. And his name is awesome, and it's jersey-worthy if you're a fan of the Dolphins. His name is Jake Butt, and he is a fantastic inline blocker and an even better pass catcher. And I think he would be a great red zone threat. I think he would fit this offense to a T, and I think he kind of relegates Marquise Gray to a backup role. And I know you like Deion Sims, Kevin, but I think the upgrade, you mentioned kind of some of the spots and offense being kind of solidified right now with the offensive line, the running backs, the receivers are what they are, with Devontae Parker possibly going out if anyone was going to leave this roster. But I think if you can upgrade that tight end spot and get a better short yardage pass catcher, a red zone threat, and a guy that just kind of can know the offense right away, learn the offense. He's a smart guy. He's a cerebral guy, and he's a really good route runner and just an overall awesome tight end. I think he probably goes in the second round, hopefully to our pick when we pick in that second round. So you had listed a couple guys you were curious about in this upcoming draft, and did you want to go ahead and touch on them?
Yeah, sure. I'll actually give you a teammate of Jake Butt's on the defensive side. Everyone knows about Jabril Peppers and Chris Wormley and some of those guys, but I'll give you a guy that would probably find a nice fit in the wide nine, kind of reminds me of Jason Jones, who we have on the roster right now, but that is Michigan defensive end Taco Charlton.
What a name.
So I think I just one-upped you in terms of the names.
That's so good.
Kudos to his parents for naming him Taco.
Is that his actual name?
Yeah, Taco.
Good for him.
And I don't even know if he has a real name or not. I'm just going to pretend his name is Taco. But he's a big defensive end, long guy, 6'6", 270 pounds. I think he's really kind of coming into his own this year. He's got 4.5 sacks on the season. Just a big, stout guy. Not super fast, not super athletic, but just kind of gets the job done. And, you know, I'm kind of bummed because I doubt we're going to be in that Myles Garrett range in the first round. But, you know, looking at some of the middle rounds, I think Taco Charlton might be a guy you could get, you know, in the third or fourth round that can come in and at least be part of the rotation. And I actually doubled up. And I'll give you an offensive player this week as well that Taco Charlton's going to have the opportunity to stop here in a few weeks. And that is an Ohio State Buckeye. He is actually the only player in Division I to have both 500 yards rushing and 500 yards receiving, and that is Curtis Samuel, who sort of plays the old Percy Harvin role in the Urban Meyer offense for the Buckeyes. He's a smaller guy. He's 5'11", about 195, 200 pounds. Kind of does a little bit of everything. Almost kind of reminds me of Jarvis Landry in a way. He'll line up in the backfield. He'll line up in the slot. They'll line him up out wide. He has returned kickoffs in the past. He's not doing it this year. Just a good all-around threat, you know, not super fast, but fast enough to play at the NFL level, kind of like a combination of the three players I thought of, and I can't believe that's three, were Randall Cobb, because he kind of plays some of those roles, Ty Montgomery for the Packers, and kind of a combination of Jarvis Landry and Kenyon Drake for Miami. Just kind of an all-around player who can do a little bit of everything. So those are my two prospects to watch from this weekend.
Well, let's just hope that that relationship between Jake Butt and Taco Charlton is completely platonic, because we don't want them getting married and having Taco's name be Taco Butt. So, that's my joke. That's our episode of the Finalysis Podcast. Again, thanks for listening again, guys. Just a little bit of housekeeping for you guys. Make sure you check out the Perfectville Podcast with Chris and Sam. Those guys are awesome. They just put out an episode today, so that's available for you on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and welcome to perfectville.com. We'll be on iTunes. Please go on there, rate us, review, write a review for us, and subscribe to our podcast. It gets us more more exposure and can get us more listeners and can help us keep going with this whole project. So we appreciate you guys listening to us. Make sure you check out my blog portion on Welcome to Perfectville. That is Wright, Travis, Wright, and Kevin. Any last words for us here, bud?
I'm going to go fins up and beer down as I finish off this beer for the evening.
You enjoy that, sir. Enjoy that 3-game winning streak. And thanks for bearing with me while I'm sick today, guys. I know I kind of mumbled over some words, but I appreciate you hanging in there with us. So have a good night, guys, and fins up. Beer down.
Thanks for listening to The Finalysis with Travis Wingfield and Kevin Dern. Subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes, and go to welcometoperfectfield.com for the very best coverage of your Miami Dolphins. Fins up.